It's The Takeaway for Wednesday, July 3rd. I'm Arun Venugopal. Tanzina is back tomorrow. Offensive Facebook posts have revealed a culture of bigotry among Border Patrol agents.
When that's the framework and you see people as illegal and maybe not people, then it's not unfathomable that they would put them in squalid conditions or that people would maybe be forced to drink out of toilets.
Is reform possible within Customs and Border Protection? Also, social media companies are starting to combat the spread of medical news that is actually wrong and dangerous.
There tends to be this kernel of truth to the things that are being advocated. And so it raises hope for people who are, you know, battling these conditions. It's unfounded, unfortunately.
Plus, the Baltimore Symphony Orchestra is protesting proposed pay cuts, putting a strain on the organization and its close ties to the city's communities.
They seem to be an orchestra aware of the city, especially because there are so many activist musicians who are making sure that their presence is felt, whether they're playing at a little library somewhere in the inner city or wherever they go.
First up, Border Patrol. On Monday, an explosive report from ProPublica started to shake up the immigration enforcement establishment. The piece by reporter A.C. Thompson said that current and former Customs and Border Protection officials had been sharing racist and sexist memes on a Facebook page created for CBP officials. Members of the Facebook group made jokes about dead migrant children and even posted sexually violent imagery directed at Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. U.S. Border Patrol Chief Carla Provost said in a statement, "These posts are completely inappropriate and contrary to the honor and integrity I see and expect from our agents day in and day out. Any employees found to have violated our standards of conduct will be held accountable." Now, many are asking whether the Facebook group represents a fringe piece of an agency that employs tens of thousands of people or reveals something about the wider culture of Border Patrol. And this all comes at a moment when horrific conditions and treatment of migrants at the southern U.S. border continue to come to light. Joining me now is Jen Budd, former Border Patrol agent. Jen, thank you for being here.
Oh, thank you for having me.
What was your immediate reaction to the story about this secret Facebook group?
I'd have to say that I wasn't surprised at all. This is the typical way that the Border Patrol operates. It's normal everyday conduct for Border Patrol agents. It's been going on for decades. You know, they claim they're going to do something about it, but nobody really ever does.
Have you yourself had access to this Facebook group?
Oh, no. I would never belong to something like that.
So it sounds like from what you're saying that this is thousands of people have access to this group, that's basically it's not a few people, a few bad apples, if you will, in this group are saying offensive things, but that it essentially defines this group of thousands of people.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the numbers that they put up, they said that there was 9,500 people that belonged to that group at any given time. They've got roughly around 19,000 plus agents. So, and, you know, I realize some of them may have been retired or whatever, but that's still a significant amount of people. And people often ask me, when I was there, what percentage maybe I thought that the attitude was like that in the Border Patrol. And I'd say roughly a good 80%.
When did you start at Border Patrol yourself?
In 1995, under the Clinton administration. I had graduated from Auburn University with a degree in law and had decided I really didn't want to go to law school. So somebody told me that the Border Patrol was hiring. Being from Alabama, I never even heard of it, but it was a federal job and they offered to send me out to California, and I thought it sounded like a pretty neat adventure. And, you know, they said that basically I would be trying to stop drug smugglers and things like that. So it sounded like an adventure.
2 weeks ago, Jen, you wrote on your blog an open letter to your former colleagues in Border Patrol. Let me just quote a few lines from that now. "You are the enablers of a deportation force responsible for separating families, terrorizing communities, and responsible for enforcing policies that have killed thousands of people, including six children since November who died in U.S. custody. I mean, you didn't really sign up to put babies in cages and babysit them, am I right? You didn't really wake up one day and decide you thought sending people who were escaping violence and terror to concentration camps was a good thing, did you? It sounds like you came from a very different perspective from the people who I guess you were working alongside with, weren't you?
You know, I think most people who join the Border Patrol do so with good intentions. And that's where that comes from is I recognize that many of them were probably like me. And I've always just felt that if you stayed in, especially nowadays, knowing what's going on, I mean, I just don't know how they can do what they're doing. I'm sorry, I'm at a loss for words, but it's just, I just don't understand how they can do this and not have any sympathy for these people when these people aren't even committing crimes. They're only seeking asylum.
So to what extent do people get socialized or desensitized to this kind of behavior you're referring to? Is it something that they come in with a certain attitude or is it something that slowly sort of takes root the more you work there?
I think nowadays it's two kinds of people. Like you just said, there are some people that this is just fine with them and they don't want specifically brown people coming into our country and changing the demographics. And I think that's because, you know, the Border Patrol has aligned itself through the union with these anti-immigrant hate groups that put out false statistics or misrepresent the statistics and try and claim that the people of color are going to change American ideals and what America is all about. And so they're really tied in with them, and that's through the union. And that's a lot of the information that Border Patrol agents today hear when they read about immigration and stuff. But then there's also the other types that it does take a while to understand the system. And it takes a while, I think, like if you're coming from a place like I was that wasn't on the border, and you're fairly ignorant of, you know, the situations down here, it could take a good 2 or 3 years before you recognize how what you're doing and enforcing is actually affecting the community and people in real life and how that happens.
How long did you stay in Border Patrol and what caused you to finally leave?
I stayed in Border Patrol pretty much 6 years to the day. So I was in a little bit of the Bush administration. I left in June of 2001. I had been questioning my actions and what I was doing. I have a degree in law, and I had gotten into law enforcement to make a difference. And I didn't feel like I was making a difference. I felt like I was spending most of my time arresting families and people that were basically just coming here trying to find a job. It's not that I didn't think that, you know, we could just have an open border, but at the same time, it just, from a law enforcement perspective, nothing was changing. And it was just a constant revolving door. And the more I spoke to the people that I was arresting and learn their stories and such, I couldn't sit there and say that I wouldn't have been doing the same thing if I needed to feed my family or my children. And so I decided that if I was going to fight this, I wasn't going to do it from the inside anymore. And I left. And that's what finally, you know, I just realized I wasn't going to make a difference at all.
Now, Border Patrol is an agency that has a hard time recruiting. Turnover is high. It's also an agency with a very low percentage of women agents. Why do you think that is?
You know, that's an interesting question. And I had really hoped that when we had our first female chief, this would actually be addressed. I'm sad to say that she just repeats the same mantra that the Border Patrol puts out, is that, you know, it's a really dangerous job, and it's very difficult in hiking the terrain and it's in desolate areas. But that's actually not at all the truth. Women, you know, are just fine out there. I've met wonderful and excellent female agents, and I've met really bad male agents. So gender really has little to do with it. The truth is that from the time you're in the academy, the Border Patrol sets an attitude that women are different than men. When I was there, and they separated the men from the women the first day and told the men that the women didn't belong there and that they couldn't hack it.
Thank you, Jen. Jen Budd is a former Border Patrol agent. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
For more on how the culture inside Border Patrol is affecting migrants, we go now to someone who's closely followed the agency. Tina Vasquez is senior immigration reporter at Rewired.news. Tina, we're glad to have you back on the show.
Thank you for having me.
What have you found is the general attitude of Border Patrol agents to migrants who are seeking asylum?
As this has sort of been unfolding, I remember a few years ago reading this book called Migra by Kelly Hernandez, and it talks about Border Patrol's formation in the 20s and how it had this unique police function of distributing state violence in the pursuit of migration control. That's how she phrased it. And so I'm not surprised by what has been unfolding. I think it's part of the root of what Border Patrol is and does. It decides who's illegal, who's legal, and that's still a conversation that the agency has. And I think that's dehumanizing, and I think the media has come to see that language is dehumanizing, but that's kind of just how Border Patrol has operated. And so when that's the framework and you see people as illegal and maybe not people, then it's not unfathomable that they would put them in squalid conditions or that people would maybe be forced to drink out of toilets. To me, it makes sense. And I wasn't surprised by what I saw this week, but I think it's really troubling.
Have you seen the culture of Border Patrol or their attitude towards migrants change at all from the Obama to the Trump administration?
Under Obama, what was being expressed a lot by Border Patrol agents and their union was that he was sort of hindering them from being able to do their job, which is an insane assertion because we've, you know, come to understand Obama's immigration record as not being a great one and for deporting a lot of people. So the idea that Obama was not letting them do their job, it was forcing them to catch and release, as they said, it didn't make any sense. But under Trump, certainly, like, the Border Patrol's union endorsed Trump. You know, that represents 16,000 active Border Patrol agents. And that was a really unprecedented step. They'd never before done that in their history. And I think the ProPublica reporting was really interesting, the timeline that was laid out. The group was formed in August 2016, just a few months before President Donald Trump was elected. I mean, I don't think that's a coincidence. So I think there's been a marked shift in that Border Patrol agents have always wanted to operate this way, but felt hindered or hampered by whoever the administration was or by the laws in place. But now we have a president who's willing to shift the policies in ways that are certainly unethical, often sometimes illegal. So I think that has been a shift, and it's very dangerous because it's killing people, literally.
What would it take to actually change the way Border Patrol and its agents operate?
That's a hard question. I can't envision Border Patrol operating another way. I mean, it's operated with these functions since it formed in the 1920s. It's very different than ICE, where ICE formed after 9/11. I mean, Border Patrol has, in a few years, will have been around almost 100 years, and this is the way that it's always operated, from this kind of dehumanizing framework. I don't know what overhauling Border Patrol would look like, because these issues are systemic. They're not entirely tied to Donald Trump. They're not new. This is just how the agency has operated.
Tina Vasquez is a senior immigration reporter at Rewire.news. Thank you so much for joining us today, Tina.
Thank you for having me.
In Yemen, more than 90,000 people have died during the country's years-long war. That's according to the latest totals reported by the Armed Conflict Location and Event Data Project. And a new report from the UN details how violence in the country has particularly impacted Yemen's children. The UN found that more than 7,500 children in Yemen have been either killed or wounded since 2013. But accurate numbers are hard to get, and many experts say the total is likely far higher. Tamer Kirolos is Yemen Country Director for Save the Children. I asked him why children continue to be especially vulnerable in this conflict.
the warring parties have not really abided by international laws, whether humanitarian law or human rights law, which protect children and protect civilians and civilian infrastructure in a conflict. What we've seen is that over the course of the last few years, in terms of the casualties, they're in the wrong place at the wrong time. What we've seen is specifically with airstrikes, shelling and other explosive weaponry, specifically in highly dense urban areas, children are much more vulnerable to these, unfortunately, because of their height, they're closer to the ground, which means that the explosion, that they're much more vulnerable to be hit. Their small body mass and size means that it's more likely that shrapnel will hit a vital organ. So in a sense, they're not being specifically targeted, but because of the conflict specifically in urban areas, they have fallen victim to this.
The report mentions that the figures are likely to worsen because monitoring numbers in Yemen is getting more difficult. Why is that?
Well, by and large, of course, because of access. As in any place where you have a conflict, it's harder and harder for the international community, humanitarian community, to actually verify and reach those places where children are being killed or wounded.
Tamer, it's been months since that photo we mentioned by Tyler Hicks of the New York Times. It shows a painfully emaciated girl by the name of Amal Hussein, woke the world up, much of the world up, to the horrors facing kids in Yemen. Clearly, Amal was starving before she died. How big is the starvation problem in Yemen right now, especially when it comes to kids?
Well, unfortunately, we've had over the last 4 years a spike in the number of children who are severely malnourished, acutely malnourished, wasting away. We did an estimate late last year in terms of potentially the numbers that could have died, and we estimate that some 85,000 children could have died because of malnutrition and starvation. It's really terrible because in many instances, the war has created problems with access to food for many families. Poverty has increased. You know, health facilities are not functioning. They're harder to get out. So parents are making very tough decisions about how they use the resources they have, and in some cases come to health facilities or health clinics a bit too late. It is really worrying. And the situation overall in the country in terms of food security, that means the ability, you know, food security is about really whether you know or not where your next meal is coming from. And what we're seeing potentially is the situation getting much, much worse. So unfortunately, and despite all the efforts, things look worse now than they did a few months ago.
So I guess that answers the question I was about to ask you, which is, to what extent did that photo inspire any change from the international community?
Well, to a certain degree, I think there's a combination of issues and factors, political, that did push all the warring parties last December to meet in Stockholm to discuss potential first steps in looking towards a longer-term solution, a peaceful solution, of course, and cessation of hostilities. And there were some very basic agreements in Stockholm, including redeployment of the warring parties around the port city of Hodeida. And unfortunately, since that agreement back on the 13th of December, we're estimating that some 8 children a day continue to be killed or wounded in the conflict. So unfortunately, it hasn't really made the impact and effect that it should have. We need much more effort to make sure that the situation of civilians in Yemen, the conflict and children in Yemen, who are not just being killed and wounded, but also facing trauma in terms of being there, seeing the shelling, losing family members, being displaced. And a lot of them just want to be normal children. So unfortunately, no, it hasn't had the impact that we would have wanted or expected.
For many of us in the West, this is a problem of an invisible war. It's not something that we're necessarily engaging with meaningfully through our media. If you could give me some sense of the day-to-day life for children who are alive in Yemen right now, what is that like?
Well, as I said, many of these children have been displaced, having to have moved with their families from areas where there's conflict. They struggle to go to school. We have at least 4 million children who don't go to school now in Yemen because the schools aren't functioning or the parents can't afford it. Their families struggle to feed them. They are not protected in many instances. Children face violence because of the conflict, but also because of the stress and the tension within families and the communities. And a lot of them don't see a future. So unfortunately, as I said, this is very bleak for this generation, and I guess for following generations for Yemen if the war does not stop.
I know that access to schools, as you said, has been badly impacted by the conflict. Can you talk about the efforts that are going on to get an education to children who are on the ground? Is that even a priority at this point?
Well, unfortunately, in many humanitarian crises, education isn't a priority. However, as Save the Children and with other partners, with UNICEF and other organizations that are focused also on education in this setting, we have made progress. We are trying our best to basically have catch-up classes for the children who've dropped out, supporting school infrastructure to a certain degree, teacher incentives, to be able to at least get the children in school. And I think the key element here is not just the children getting an education. Schools are a protective environment and can be a protective environment in the case of conflict where children are at risk of so many different dangers. Schools are a great place to help them both deal with the issues in terms of the psychological stress, but also is a protection mechanism. So education has both an educational and protection purpose. We have definitely made inroads, but there's so much more resources needed. And as always, we call for an international community and donors to invest more in education, because it's not just about today, but it's really about the future of the country.
Tamer Karolos is the Yemen Director for Save the Children. Thanks for joining us, Tamer.
Thank you.
Videos advocating dubious medical practices are booming on social media. YouTube and Facebook have been flooded with unfounded advice on treatments for severe medical issues, like suggesting you inject baking soda to curb the threat of cancer. Platforms including YouTube and Facebook say that they're now taking action to keep snake oil cures from gaining traction, and those salesmen from cashing in on false claims. Daniela Hernandez has been reporting on this. She's digital science editor at The Wall Street Journal. Welcome to The Takeaway, Daniela.
Hi, thanks for having me.
We hear a lot of misinformation campaigns when it comes to vaccines, obviously. What other health issues have come up in this spread of misinformation online?
Well, cancer, as we point out in the story, is a big one, but it really does span the gamut. Medical misinformation is just another flavor of all the misinformation that's out there that's proliferating on social media.
And where is all this fake medical news coming from, and how is it getting circulated?
Well, there are some reports that we didn't have time to get into in this story, or the story that we reported on vaccines a couple of months ago, of Russian bots spreading misinformation about vaccines. There was a study a while back about that. Our report, this one that came out this morning in the paper, really focused on cancer. And so we looked at social media accounts that promoted treatments that were not scientifically validated. And so these are accounts on YouTube, on Twitter, on Facebook, really everywhere. For consumers, it's hard for them to really understand what's reliable and what's not for anybody. Partly because, as the oncologist that I talked to mentioned, there tends to be this kernel of truth to the things that are being advocated. And so what that means is that they might reference a study in a lab, but that intervention hasn't been tested in humans and it's being presented as something that can be curative when in fact it hasn't been vetted. And so it raises hope for people who are, you know, battling these conditions.
And you're saying it's a lot of times it's Russian bots who are behind this?
I'm not saying that it's a lot of the times it's Russian bots behind this. I'm saying that there was one particular study that suggested that.
Okay.
But the accounts that we featured in our story seem to be real accounts.
Okay. So I don't get that much medical misinformation or information even in my Facebook feed, but I always see these weird pictures in ads at the bottom of various web pages saying things like, you know, experts say ingesting this sea creature is the key to your prostate health. And they'll show something really creepy or ferocious, like a piranha or a sea slug or something. And I'm always like, what on earth is going on here? I mean, there's just such weird specious stuff floating out there, clearly somehow targeting middle-aged dude like myself.
Well, the hard thing is that, as we point out in the story, it's so easy to publish on the internet, right? And it's really hard for anyone, including the tech companies, to really vet the validity of it. Science is really nuanced and complicated, and it's asking a lot for a consumer who is looking for information. I mean, just think about yourself. Like, you might have the flu, or your child might be sick. you might not be able to call your doctor right away, right? So you go on Google and you type in a search and out comes information. Sometimes that information is valid and reliable, but sometimes it might not. And what's really difficult is that sometimes the information that is valid is peppered with results that are not. And so it's hard to gauge whether something that you're reading is actually accurate.
Is it possible to know how much people are actually profiting from these things?
We tried to quantify that in our pre-reporting, and it's difficult because some of that data just lives with the tech companies.
Can you tell us about the case of Robert Young?
That's a complicated one. So there's this guy in California who was convicted of practicing medicine without a license. And he still has a presence on social media, a YouTube channel where he's prominently featured, several Facebook pages, one that we mentioned in the story with about 60,000 followers. And it's a pretty active page. There's posts regularly that hawk everything from supplements to services. There was a post back a couple of months ago saying that he was going to present the cure for cancer at a medical meeting, I think abroad. And that cure was baking soda, and that the medical establishment was preventing patients from accessing that.
And how is one supposed to, I guess, ingest or, you know, take in this baking soda? We're talking about injections?
That's what our reporting showed from talking to prosecutors, that was through IV, yes.
And what would the result be if you actually did that?
Well, it's part of this bigger treatment regimen that he was promoting, keeping the body at an optimal level of acidity. And baking soda keeps the acid levels down. And so he thinks that by doing that, it can prevent or cure all sorts of diseases, cancer included.
But is it clear what would happen or what has happened even from anyone who's followed this advice?
Well, I can't say that like this particular regimen ended up in the death of the woman that we talk about in the story, but you know, she was somebody who was really desperate to find a cure for her condition. She had breast cancer. So she found him on the internet and went to his ranch in California, ended up spending tens of thousands of dollars, and she had a very progressed cancer. The regimens of juicing and whatnot probably didn't help. Like she was probably not eating enough and her immune system was already down. So it's a whole combination of things. It's really sad. And what doctors were really concerned about is that, you know, these patients, sometimes medicine can't help them. Like the cancer's too advanced or there isn't a treatment for it. And they're just looking for hope, right? You want to help yourself or your loved one. And unfortunately, sometimes the science just isn't there to do that. And so they look to other means. And it's, you know, you can understand that. Like when you're desperate like that, you want to be able to say, like, I did everything I could. It's just, it's human to want to do that.
Daniela Hernandez is digital science editor at The Wall Street Journal. Thank you for your reporting, Daniela.
Thank you.
They seem to be an orchestra aware of the city, especially because there are so many activist musicians who are making sure that their presence is felt, whether they're playing at a little library somewhere in the inner city or wherever they go.
That's Tim Smith, former classical music and theater critic for the Baltimore Sun. And he's talking about the Baltimore Symphony Orchestra, the BSO. Right now, the musicians of the BSO are making their presence felt in the city, but not through music. They're on the picket line protesting a contract proposal that would cut their paid work weeks from 52 to 40. And due to a recent budget shortfall, the orchestra's summer season has been canceled and the musicians have been locked out of work. Here to walk us through the situation in Baltimore and tell us what it means for orchestras across the country is Anne Midgett, classical music critic for The Washington Post. Anne, thanks for coming on The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me.
So, Anne, what are the specific grievances the Baltimore Orchestra musicians have here?
Well, I mean, their first grievance is that they've been locked out and they're not allowed to go into the building and get any of their things. So it's not as if they've walked out on strike. The orchestra's administration has been trying since the fall to cut the season from 52 to 40 weeks on grounds of economic necessity, which is an argument that admittedly can be made. Around the country, we're seeing trends in that direction. We're seeing orchestras that have tried it. We're seeing orchestras that are doing okay with it. However, to suddenly lock out your musicians and cut off their health insurance, although the health insurance has since been made up by private donors for the summer, is perhaps not the kindest or least confrontational way to go about it. And at the very least, I'd say the administration has a PR problem at the moment.
So musicians and employers are always going through tense negotiations, but a lockout like this, is that relatively unusual?
We've seen several of them in the orchestra world, unfortunately. The Minnesota Orchestra had a 15-month lockout a couple of years ago and has emerged from it okay, very happily. One always worries in these times when classical music has less of a foothold in the culture than it perhaps did 50 years ago, that the result of this kind of labor dispute is going to be a sort of battered orchestra. But that hasn't necessarily been the rule across the board. It's very individual from community to community how an orchestra survives and how it relates to its community. So it's hard to make blanket statements beyond the fact that, yes, ticket sales are not going upward these days.
So is that largely the issue, you think, that classical music simply doesn't have the purchase that it did 50 years ago and people just have other things to do with their money and time?
I think one of the big issues is that the orchestra field overexpanded in the 70s and 80s. The 52-week season is a relatively recent phenomenon, really from the 70s. Before that, most orchestras were part-time, even the big ones, and musicians did other things in the off-season. I'm not saying that's better. Of course, if you want somebody to play as well as the Berlin Philharmonic plays, it's better to play year-round. But whether the market ever was set up to support the number of 52-week orchestras that we have, I might question. And a lot of orchestras that are doing really well artistically and in terms of audience are smaller orchestras with shorter seasons. That said, I think there should be a certain number of 52-week seasons. I think we're going to see a certain amount of market correction. And this is obviously a very painful thing to people who have spent their whole lives learning how to play these instruments at an incredible level of skill. To have your salary suddenly cut by 20% through no fault of your own is a bitter, bitter pill to swallow. And it behooves administrations to try to approach that sensitively and tactfully, as some have managed to do.
That's right. These are people who may have been playing their violin or their cello since age of five. They've
Absolutely.
Spent their whole lifetime. What is it like from your perspective to be a musician, an artist, play music with all these stresses and frustrations hovering over you?
Well, we all in our work lives have stresses and frustrations hovering over us. And I've pointed out in my writing quite a bit that what's going on in classical music is not unique to classical music. The 21st century has brought sea change to a lot of big institutions, very much including the daily newspaper. Print journalism is going through many of the same pains of readjustment that classical music is. And in many ways, print journalism offers some of the same templates. There are plenty of classical musicians who have thriving freelance careers. That is not as nice as having a permanent job with health insurance and benefits. But it is the sort of order of the day, and that's, again, across the economy, not just musicians. Is it hard to make music under those circumstances? Probably. But we could also add that, you know, making music in an orchestra is a job, too, for people and comes with its own sets of annoyances. So I don't think it helps to put music on this pedestal that these musicians are somehow, you know, exempt from the cares of everyday world or feel these cares more keenly. A good professional musician is going to, you know, play his or her best when given an opportunity. And I think the musicians, in terms of just playing, are going to be playing their hearts out in the coming weeks and pick up concerts and whatnot. And if and when they come back in the fall, I imagine there'll be some great concerts. But of course, it's very much open to question what's going to happen in the fall and how this is all going to shake down.
Well, one thing that distinguishes the BSO is community outreach. They went out and played vigils mourning the death of Freddie Gray in police custody. How common is that kind of outreach?
Outreach is one of the big buzzwords in orchestras today. As orchestras started looking around and saying, hey, our communities don't see us as these flagship institutions that we were 50 years ago, they're trying to play catch up a little bit. And you're seeing lots and lots of orchestras emphasize different ways to get out of the community, reach the community. The Detroit Symphony, which had a long and bitter strike a few years ago and did shrink from a 52-week season to a 40-week season, has, since it returned, made a point of going out into the community and just giving concerts regularly in different neighborhoods that weren't as served before. You see lots of different permutations of it. Baltimore Symphony has a program for inner city kids called Orc Kids, which goes into schools and offers orchestral instruction and after school work like 5 days a week. It's a sort of a big family buy-in thing. Well, that's great, but that's an offshoot of the program El Sistema from Venezuela, which is being tried out again in a number of different cities by a number of different orchestras. In the wake of the lockout situation, I've heard from people who felt that the Baltimore Symphony didn't do enough to reach its community. So that's kind of a vexed question, or certainly a question of perspective. There's a big African-American community in Baltimore, and while Baltimore has tried some things to expand its Black audience, I think that a lot of Black musicians and listeners feel maybe that's not quite enough. These are bigger questions, of course, than just Baltimore as well. The classical music field is traditionally very white and perceived as elitist, and it's trying to lose those descriptors, and that's a hard thing to do.
Anne Midgett is classical music critic for The Washington Post. Anne, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
That's our show for today. I'm Arun Venugopal. It's been great hosting the show this week. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Arun, NYC, A-R-U-N-N-Y-C. Tanzina Vega will be back tomorrow. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Arun Venugopal, and this is The Takeaway.